From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Catty Kay, sitting in for Diane, who is in Maine on a station visit. The Greek government teetered on the brink of collapse as it announced it would not proceed with a referendum on the EU bailout plan. Leaders meeting at the G20 summit in Cannes breathed a sigh of relief. Libya appointed a new interim prime minister. Syria agreed to a plan to end violence in the country, but the crackdown continued. The Palestinians got a boost in their bid for statehood after UNESCO, the UN's cultural body, admitted them as a member. And a French paper was firebombed after putting an image of the Prophet Muhammad on its cover. The international hour of the Friday news roundup, but first this update.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The nation's unemployment rate has edged down a bit, declining a tenth of a percent to 9%. The Labor Department says there was a net gain of 80,000 new jobs in October, and job creation numbers for the previous 2 months have been revised upward. But economist Hugh Johnson says there are many factors helping keep the nation's unemployment rate stubbornly high.
Clearly, this economy is struggling, or it's being held in check by housing problems in Europe, problems that affected us from Japan and the rise in oil prices. A lot of sort of headwinds have affected the economy and slowed the growth of employment, so it's not doing what it ordinarily would do in an economic recovery.
President Obama says the anemic job creation numbers are all the more reason for lawmakers in Congress to reconsider their rejection of elements of his jobs plan.
When they look at today's job numbers, which were positive, but indicate once again that the economy is growing way too slow, that they think twice before they vote no again.
The president speaking at the conclusion of the summit of the world's major economies in France today.
Our European partners have laid a foundation on which to build, and it has all the elements needed for success.
House Speaker John Boehner says additional tax revenue could be part of the deficit reduction plan that's being worked on by a congressional supercommittee, as long as there are also significant reforms to benefit programs. Boehner says dealing with the deficit is difficult but essential.
The budget deficit and our debt serves as a wet blanket over our economy. It has every investor and business person concerned about whether we're going to deal with this problem.
The bipartisan committee is struggling to agree on ways to cut the deficit by more than $1 trillion over the next decade. They must come up with a plan by Thanksgiving. Former New Jersey Governor John Corzine has resigned as chief executive of the failed securities firm MF Global. NPR's Mike Pesca says Corzine is declining to accept the $12 million in severance payments he was entitled to receive under the terms of his employment contract.
Corzine, who used the fortune he amassed as CEO of Goldman Sachs to fund his run for senator and then governor of New Jersey, wanted to turn MF Global into a bigger Wall Street player. To that end, he oversaw his new firm's aggressive positions on foreign debt, positions which began to look shakier as the global financial crisis grew. Days ago, MF Global declared bankruptcy, and federal regulators are investigating over $600 million that are still missing from investor funds. Corzine, a critic of Wall Street excess as a public servant, came in for criticism himself for allowing his firm to be highly leveraged, essentially a replay of the financial crisis of 2008. Mike Pesca, NPR News, New York.
Stock prices are sagging on Wall Street. The Dow is down 144 points. The Nasdaq Composite is off 29. This is NPR News from Washington. People in India are facing sharp increases in the cost of food and fuel. NPR's Corey Flintoff reports officials there are worried that inflation could put a crimp in India's phenomenal economic growth rate.
The Indian government just allowed gasoline prices to rise for the fifth time in the past year. Gasoline is now more than 12% more costly than it was in January. The move comes just days after a report that retail food prices were also up by 12% over the same period. India's finance minister called that a dangerously high rate of inflation. The Reserve Bank of India has been raising interest rates throughout the past year in an effort to stem inflation, but some experts say the real solution is to increase the supplies of food and fuel. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, New Delhi.
Washington Governor Chris Gregoire is floating the idea of eliminating school buses in her state as a way to help close its $2 billion budget shortfall. The move would save an estimated $220 million. Tom Bishop is transportation manager for Seattle's public schools. He says he fears the change would cause a drop in student attendance.
Anything they do, especially at this point, of cutting back on transportation could have a truly adverse impact on truancy.
And parent Deborah Carnes agrees.
A lot of the kids in poverty and English as a second language, I'm concerned that they will just stop showing up for school.
Eliminating school bus transportation is just one of a number of possibilities Gregoire has listed in advance of a special session of the Washington State Legislature later this month to deal with the budget deficit. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors mileage and safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate. Learn more at progressive.com.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Catty Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Diane is in Maine for a station visit. She'll be back on Monday. The Prime Minister of Greece struggles to hold on to his job. European economic troubles overshadow the G20 meeting in France. And violence continues in Syria despite a deal with the Arab League. Joining me in the studio to discuss this week's top international news stories, James Kitfield, senior correspondent with National Journal, Courtney Cuby, national security producer for NBC News, Robin Harding, U.S. economics editor for the Financial Times. All of you, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Here.
We will be opening the phones in about half an hour. The 1-800-433-8850 is the phone number here. Do give us a call with your questions and comments and send us an email, drshow@wmu.org. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter as well. James, let me start with you. Greek tragedy, Greek drama, Greek farce. What's going on in Athens this week?
It's like watching a slow motion train wreck. It really is. And unfortunately, when that train does wreck, it's going to take down possibly the world financial system with it. And so here we have little Greece who's, through this. Last week we had this big deal that the Europeans got together, basically going to bail them out, but on agreement they'll have these austerity measures. They're going to shore up the central bank. Monday, Papandreou from Greece throws this in total turmoil and says he's going to put this deal to a referendum. You know, we've seen how unpopular these austerity measures are already with the riots all throughout Athens and the rest of Greece. So that just threw financial markets into a tizzy right on the eve of this G20 vote. The good news is he's backed off of this. There will be no referendum now. He apparently was actually doing a little maneuvering job so he could solidify his position within his own government, maybe hang on to power and form a unity government. But it gets to the core of what's the problem with the Eurozone, which is that you have a consensus to get into this thing altogether, but never a consensus to break all the rules about debt ratios, et cetera, but never a consensus on the kind of financial an institutional framework that would make a financial union coherent. So now we're facing very tough decisions, and any small country we're starting to figure out in Europe can bring the whole process to a grinding halt if their parliament balks.
Okay, Courtney, I'm fascinated by what's happening in Greece because I do think it gets, as James is suggesting, to the kind of heart of what the euro is about, but it also gets to national characteristics because the polls show in Greece this week that a majority of Greeks want to stay and be part of the Eurozone. A similar majority of Greeks don't want the austerity measures that it's going to take in order to keep them in the Eurozone. I mean, this is the fundamental problem, right?
Exactly. And that's one of the reasons, presumably, that Prime Minister Papandreou put this or threatened to put this to a referendum was it was so domestically unpopular. The bailout essentially said that the other European zone leaders, primarily Germany and France, were going to provide another $11 billion in November. But then they were also going to forgive about half of the debt that Greece owed to banks. But in response for that, there were these tremendous austerity measures that the Greek people were going to have to endure. And that included more unemployment. There would be fewer pensions. They were going to have higher taxes. The Greek people have been putting up with these austerity measures for about a year now, and they are furious. There's been unprecedented protests. There have been strikes. But what it really goes to is when you look at the difference between the two of the nations that are involved here, Greece and Germany, the German people are also kind of upset. They're saying, you know, we don't have these luxurious, really, lifestyles that some of these Greek people who work for the government and are able to afford. For instance, they retire at 50. They have, you know, weeks and weeks of vacation every single year, mandatory vacation. So the German people, who one could argue really should have had the referendum whether they wanted to provide this money to Greece, the German people are upset that they're bailing out what they look at as a lavish lifestyle and an unresponsible one.
Robin, James started by saying that this is a crisis that has knock-on effects all around the world. If I am a businesswoman in Oklahoma, why should I be bothered about what's happening in Greece this week?
Well, it's a very profound reason why you should be bothered, because if this falls apart in Greece, then the sort of chain of dominoes is going to go like this. Greece defaults on its payments to European banks. European banks go under, European banks can't repay US banks or US money market mutual funds, there'll be a big financial panic which will very quickly become global, and that's going to have knock-on effects on your ability in Oklahoma to get credit from your bank.
So it is something that the rest of the world is watching what's happening in Athens.
Absolutely.
Right today.
Absolutely, because you have to think, Athens and Greece are the role model for what could happen in much bigger European countries, which also have problems, notably Italy and notably Spain. If Greece decides not to go with an organised restructuring of its debt and accept this bailout, then people are going to think, well, Italy's going to do the same thing, and Italy owes hundreds of billions of euros to international banks. That's why the problem in a small country is actually a global problem.
Right, and that's why it's dominating the G20 meeting in Cannes, which was, of course, meant to be about the global financial crisis, and yesterday, at least, got completely hijacked by what was happening.
You know, and again, to make my earlier point, and I totally agree with that, I mean, you've already started to see the cost of borrowing for Italy jump up as the markets, you know, look down the road and look at who's the next weakest person, and they look at Italy, and Italy is almost too big to bail out. So, you know, this, and the problem is the markets move very quick, and the European Union and the Eurozone move very slow because you have to build this consensus, again, from 17 members in the Eurozone or 27 members in the European Union writ large. It's a very cumbersome process. The markets have been ahead with them every step of this crisis, and they're still playing catch-up.
Right. Okay, it's going to be incredibly difficult for Greece to make the kind of cuts, as you were suggesting, Courtney, that it needs to stay within the requirements of the bailout fund. Italy also struggling with these austerity measures. I mean, what are you looking at in terms of how the Eurozone is shaped in 5 years' time?
Well, there's actually one silver lining to this entire issue in Greece, and that may be that it may actually force Italy to accept that it has an even bigger problem that Greece has right now and to take measures now. You know, for instance, Greece is right now at about $450 billion in debt. Well, Italy is $2.5 trillion. As James was saying, they are not bailoutable at this point. It's just too big.
So are we thinking that this G20 meeting is a turning point in history, Robin? That this is the moment we'll look back and think, you know, this is the beginning of a smaller Eurozone?
I think not. And I can't think of any G20 meeting ever. In fact, or any G7 meeting for the last 20 or 30 years that would be regarded as a turning point in history.
Is it the moment? Too big a phrase there. But my sense is out of this G20 meeting, there is now explicit recognition that Greece might leave the Eurozone. And that has not been said explicitly before by European leaders.
Well, that's certainly true. And I think we are moving to a little crisis point in this series of crises. But I think the thing you have to recognise about what's been happening in Europe for more than a year now is we have a crisis and then a little bailout is agreed to paper over it, and we have another crisis, and another little bailout is agreed to paper things over until the next time. The trouble is, there's a really fundamental, deep problem which has to be addressed. You have to completely change the nature of the Greek and Italian economy from accepting financing from Germany and using it to buy Mercedes to actually producing something themselves and persuading the Germans that they want to buy it. So there's no short solution to this, and that's why the Greek measures involve such a lot of pain. It involves a decade of pain. There really is no quick and easy answer to this. And that's why I think we've not reached a sort of turning point yet.
OK, James, news coming out from Cannes, where the G20 meeting is happening. President Obama has just said that the US economy is growing way too slow. And he said, put simply, the world faces challenges that put our economic recovery at risk. Of course, the Americans, again, very focused on what's happening there in Europe this week.
And he made an interesting point. I mean, if you look at, you know, that he was sympathetic to how difficult it is for all these European leaders. I mean, look how difficult it has been for him and for the Republicans to agree on a way forward with either stimulus or cuts in the deficit. I mean, there's a fundamental disagreement that has split this country basically in half, and it's tied his hands. So you have this sort of situation where the president's running around promoting a jobs bill that doesn't have a chance in Hades of actually passing, really starting the campaign season right now, but not doing anything for the job situation. So, I mean, I think it gets to the point that when we, in 2008, when the crisis first erupted, a lot of people threw a lot of money, a lot of countries threw a lot of money at this crisis, and there is debt weariness in a lot of our societies, and it certainly is in our own society. So we're at a really rough patch for the global economy. I mean, I think he can claim that, the stimulus did keep it from getting worse, as you talked about in your earlier segment, but it's going to be a tough motto to run on next year for him.
Courtney, what are the Chinese saying at the end of this week? Because, of course, there had been some hope that the Chinese might offer to contribute to the bailout fund for Greece. Are they willing?
It doesn't look domestically popular for China to give any money to this bailout. And I think that's going to be one of the things that when historians look back at this G20, if they do, that comes out of it, is that France really wanted to woo China and India and say, look, Europe is a good investment. Come put your money here. And in the end, it was sort of embarrassing because everything was taken over by this news of Greece, which just looked so disorganized and it was moving so quickly that I think the Chinese leadership is going to leave there and say, well, why would we want to put money into this losing investment? I also think, frankly, that from President Obama's perspective, this marked a real shift. This was his fifth G20. And for the first time, he was not one of the major players there. And you can look at it from two perspectives. Either Europe didn't go to the U.S. and say, we need money, help us, because the U.S. really can't afford to put $150 billion into Europe right now. But not only did the U.S. not come to, I'm sorry, did Europe not come to the U.S., but they went to China. I think this will mark a real shift in how the U.S. is seen on an international stage, whether they're seen as an international player.
Meanwhile, of course, China is saying that Europe has to get its own house in order before it's going to assist with a bailout fund. We're going to take a short break. Courtney Kuby, national security producer for NBC News. James Kitfield, senior correspondent with National Journal. Robin Harding is U.S. economics editor for the Financial Times. They're all with me in the studio. We'll be taking your calls. 1-800-433-8850 is the phone number. The email address is drshow@wamu.org. It's been a very busy week. We've got to get on to Libya, Syria, a whole host of other issues that have been happening around the world. We will get to those and your calls and questions. I'm Cathy Kay. We're going to take a quick break. Stay listening. Thank you. Welcome back. I'm Katty Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Reiman, who have joined the international hour of our Friday news roundup. During the break, we got news from Greece. A senior Greek governing party lawmaker says he will not support the government in a critical confidence vote unless Prime Minister George Papandreou pledges to resign over the weekend and start talks on a caretaker government. And of course, Robin Harding, that vote due to take place in a few hours' time. How's it looking for the Prime Minister?
Well, I think Papandreou is a goner, regardless of how the vote goes. I mean, he has rolled the dice with this referendum proposal, been shot down pretty horribly. He may have actually gained something by solidifying the opposition's support for this bailout and thereby generating at least a little bit of political unity behind this, but I think it's going to come at the price of his leadership. Whether the vote passes or not, I think it's still up in the air. I think even if a number of his own lawmakers defect, it's still possible that that vote will go through if he can pick up a bit of opposition support. But either way, I don't think it really makes that much difference. He's gone. The question is whether Greece as a country and as a polity can get behind this bailout and accept the sort of decade of pain that's going to come with it.
I interviewed the Greek foreign minister who was in Washington last week, and it was just after the deal was announced, and he was very gung-ho. He said, this is all about the future. We're not looking back to the past anymore. No one can scapegoat anymore, but Greece is prepared to change. The Greek people know that they have to have this austerity. And I said, you know, look, you live in a country where paying taxes is a kind of lifestyle choice. Is that going to change? He said, that's not fair. And actually, yes, we know what the pain we have to go through. Do we love it? No, but we are going to change as a nation. Can you change people, a culture like that, James Kitfield?
I think it's difficult. And I think, I mean, you know, Robin was saying, well, Italy and Greece are going to have to sort of build economies that sell things to their northern neighbors. And, you know, maybe that happens. But it seems to me that, you know, you have to expect some unevenness in this eurozone. And
which is why now some people are talking about a kind of divided eurozone system.
Right. And, you know, and it has to be mentioned that, you know, Germany has been an export engine, but in large part because it's selling to its neighbors in Europe. So, I mean, Germany has stake in this game, if you will. But I think it'd be very hard to turn around sort of the Greek culture in a way that makes them sort of mini northern neighbors or like Scandinavians. They're not. They're Mediterraneans. They have a different kind of culture and a different approach towards work and life.
Which, Robin, explains China's reluctance.
Yes, I mean, I think it bears saying that joining Europe and joining the euro is part of a sort of effort by the Greek elite and political class to transform themselves and make themselves more European. So when you hear sort of elite Greeks saying that we want to change and we can change, I think you have to take it with a pinch of salt. The Chinese point, what I think is absolutely crazy is that the Europeans are even contemplating taking money from China. China has a huge surplus, so it has to put it somewhere. And they have to put it somewhere with a deficit, so they can put it in US bonds or in European bonds. Fine. But Europe has the European Central Bank, so, you know, it can bail out itself. It doesn't need to accept money from China with political strings attached to
it. So why did the Europeans go to China?
Well, so they have to raise this very large amount of official financing. And the only entity in Europe which can do that is the European Central Bank. The European Central Bank is very reluctant to do that, basically because it's worried about its credibility. And the reason it's worried about its credibility is because it doesn't want to give money without strings attached to Silvio Berlusconi in Italy.
I mean, Courtney Kuby, that's why we had Mario Draghi, the new president of the European Central Bank, pushing back against this idea just yesterday that the ECB was going to be the lender of last resort.
Exactly. And he surprised a lot of analysts this week when he took over. He just took over this week, kind of a tough time to take the office.
Yeah, and who'd want that job?
Absolutely. And he quickly cut interest rates by a quarter point, surprising analysts by doing a little earlier than they had anticipated before the end of the year. And he basically did it, you know, he's trying to shore up confidence in the European markets and build confidence internationally. And it stands to see if it actually works.
We have an email here from Jonathan, who writes to us from Washington, D.C. Please discuss Italy, the elephant in the room, and its leadership issues. Also, those rhinoceroses, I guess, Spain and Portugal, and what happens if China catches cold. Well, James, I'm going to ask you about Italy particularly, because there were kind of rumors swirling this week that maybe Silvio Berlusconi was going to have to go.
If everyone's looking for some sort of silver lining in this crisis, and that to me would be the silver lining if it could get Italy off its sort of stagnation and finally get rid of this guy. He's an embarrassment. He is under charges of sexual soliciting sex with minors. He's a playboy. He's been a huge distraction, and he's lorded over a period when Italy has borrowed way too heavily. And if Italy is going to be convince its neighbors in the financial markets that it's going to get its house in order, it's very hard to see how it does it with Berlusconi at the helm.
Right, but is there somebody else who can take over who you think is the kind of financial shining white knight waiting to make the cuts that Italy needs to make?
Well, I mean, it's the reason he's been in office so long is there is not that shining white knight waiting on the side. But it's getting to the point now, in my view, that it's hard to see how anyone could be worse. At this point, a technocrat right now would be who's not charismatic and is not as well known as Berlusconi might even be a good thing. But no, I don't have the name handy of a white knight who's obviously sitting on the sidelines that everyone's going to rally behind.
Yeah, but it's interesting. I mean, talking to people at the IMF this week, they're kind of iterating what you say, that at this point anyone is preferable to Berlusconi, and that it might give the market some sense of confidence that Italy is prepared to make the leadership changes. Let's shift to Libya. Courtney Kubi, we have a new prime minister who taught at the University of Alabama. He is an electronics engineer. What can you tell us about him?
Yeah, the National Transitional Council elected their new interim prime minister this week. It's Abdel Rahim El-Kib. And as you said, he taught at the University of Alabama at Tuscaloosa. And he was actually born in Tripoli, so he's considered by the Libyan people to be a Westerner, a Western side of the nation. But then he spent about four decades outside of the country. He was in opposition to Gaddafi, and he left the country. And people who taught with him and his students, there's a bunch of stories about this week about his character, and everyone speaks very highly of him. They said that one thing he never spoke much about was Libya when he lived in the United States, and that was because he was concerned about his family back home in Libya and because of his strong opposition to Gaddafi. But he came back over the summer, and he was one of the financiers of the revolution towards the end in August. What he brings to the table is the interim president right now is from the East,
right,
and he's from the West. So he's seen as the potential to unify a nation, which right now is pretty fractured, not just in its politics, its very loose, weak political structure that's just in its infancy right now, but also more so in these tremendous militias that are all over the country that are refusing to disarm, and that they either need to unify or figure out a way to disarm them, or else they're going to end up with sectarian conflict throughout the country.
Robin Harding, what's been the reaction from the United States and Europe and other members of NATO to the appointment of the new prime minister?
I think it's generally been positive, which is not really a surprise. You know, you've got a US-educated technocrat in charge of Libya. Hooray. And I think that's really the point about this man. I mean, no one can feel obviously threatened by him. I mean, he's not obviously an Islamist. He's not a general. He's not a strong man. He's going to be a technocrat. That's, you know, good from one point of view. But equally, you have to wonder, is this the man who can, you know, put Libya together? Is this the great leader, the sort of post-revolutionary leader, a Washington who's going to build a new nation? I think that's the point where you have to worry a little bit.
James.
Yeah, I mean, everyone should look at this situation, as we've seen sort of post-revolutionary situations or post-regime change civilizations, if we have some experience
with.
Excuse me?
Can be tricky.
Can be very tricky. And, you know, they can be hijacked, as we saw with Iran's revolution. It can take many years, as we saw with Iraq. But I think this is a good first step. And they're saying the right things. They're talking about forming a National Assembly within 8 months. They're talking about within 2 years transitioning to elected government. So they're saying the right things. This National Transitional Council seems to have segued into sort of an interim government in waiting. So I'm a glass half full kind of guy here, but given that nothing could be worse than Gaddafi, however, we should not take our eye off Libya because it's in for a very sort of rocky period.
Okay, it's going to be interesting to see whether the new prime minister coming from Tripoli can kind of make that bridge to Benghazi, which of course is where the National Transitional Council was based, and a lot of people in Libya very conscious that it was Benghazi that was calling the shots for quite a long time there during the rebellion. Let's go to the phones now to Don in Louisville, Kentucky. Don, you've joined the Diane Rehm Show.
Hi, thank you. I was wanting to speak to a few points to try to link them all together. One of the things that I was hearing is talking about the Greek problem was have they not done anything to try to eliminate, say, like middle management in government to try to actually decrease their debt that they have? Along with that, I mean, at the unsustainable, interest rate of like, what, 25%, how are they supposed to try to get that to become manageable if they don't do something to, get rid of people in government? And also one of the things that I was looking at is that if you look at this country here in the United States, isn't that part of the major problem that we're having now with our deficits running at 42%? And isn't that what part of the problem that's hindering this country from actually being able to help other countries? And then along with that, our decreasing role that we're taking in the world now because of what's happening with China. What's that going to do with our capabilities to protect ourselves? Okay. I mean, this is a major issue that's going on. And it's, I mean, if we don't do something, in all of these different countries, where are we going to go?
Okay, Don, I'm going to get back to your original question there about Greece and how much of the cuts that have taken place have taken in place within the public sector, Robin, because that seems to be what Don is getting at, that the Greece has got to make cuts to its public sector if it's going to try and address its deficit issues.
Well, the answer there is that Greece has been trying to cut public sector jobs. Just the trouble is that a large number of Greeks are middle managers in the public sector, and there isn't really very much else for them to go and do once they're laid off from the public sector, and so they have vigorously resisted these cuts. And a big part of the problem with these successive bailouts for Greece is that Greece has struggled to implement agreements it has made to actually cut back the size of its public sector. To your interest rate point, Don, the market rates are very high, and that's why this bailout is needed, because the bailout comes at a much lower rate of interest which Greece can actually afford to pay.
But how can you, James, square the circle, or rather how can Greece square the circle, and to some extent America is facing the same situation, of cutting public sector jobs and salaries and growing the economy in order to pay down the deficit?
Yeah, I mean, that's if I knew that, I wouldn't be sitting here. I'd be
ahead of a hedge fund. Still be with us.
It is an argument about, you know, when you turn on the gas and when you put on the brakes, and when you address your deficit and when you try to stimulate a very stagnant economy. And that's the debate we're seeing between the Republicans and the Obama White House. On the bigger issue, though, I mean, your listener raises an interesting point, which is that America is definitely going to be in a period of some retrenchment in the next decade. It's not hard to see. We're cutting defense as it is. It is open to whether this sequestration thing happens and we cut it much more. But it is going to be a challenge for us to play the role, the leadership role. We saw it this week at the G20, the kind of leadership role the world's kind of used to us playing, because we don't have the money to throw around. We're going to be in a situation where we're drawing down on our military forces, and China is got lots of money, but it's also making its neighbors very nervous with a lot of its activities. So this is strategically going to be a very difficult period to watch. I think that Courtney's absolutely right. This shift of wealth and power that is historically unprecedented, generally from the developed West to the developing Asia, with China at its center, has been accelerated dramatically by this economic crisis the world's gone through. The developing countries have done very well in a period when the developed countries are really, really reeling.
And many Americans, of course, saying that that is actually the shift that needs to take place, that America should not be spending resources and valuable lives nation-building abroad, but should be focusing, of course, on building up infrastructure here in the United States.
We have no choice.
Elizabeth in Battleground, Indiana. Elizabeth, welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Hi. I'm pretty scared talking on the radio.
Oh, don't be scared. We're very friendly.
There's many things I would like to say about Greece. I've become very tired of hearing such a sort of a partial truth told. I think what really finally frustrated me to the point to phone was this throwing out this statement, they all retire at 50, they live a lavish lifestyle. And I think that making these, there may be some people in Greece that retire at 50. Certainly all public servants do not. It's like saying, some military people here retired 50. Does that mean all people that work for the government here retired 50? I think it's really, it's not a good thing to just throw out these statements that are such a maybe a very small piece of the truth. Certainly, there's many problems there. There's corruption that goes through there. Only 40% of the population is paying income tax, but those people are paying a very high tax, and now they're paying more tax. Are they collecting the tax from the rest? No. Is there any program that plans to collect it? I mean, tax collection is one of the biggest problems, particularly from the wealthy, but also from an underground section of the economy. But that has been allowed to go because actually wages are very low compared to here. What a school teacher makes in Greece, what a university professor makes in Greece. There are some things that are, you know, odd. Maybe a truck driver makes twice as much as a university professor in some cases. There are corrupt unions and there are not. But it's been so oversimplified and so thrown out that, well, they're just all living high. They live beyond their means. It's just not true.
Okay, Elizabeth, we're going to try and unpack some of that for you because you raise a good point that we shouldn't be throwing out generalizations. Let's talk a little bit about the specifics. Robin, what can you fill us in on the specifics of how Greeks do live?
Well, I mean, I think it is true to say that Greece is a society where there are a number of insiders, people who are, you know, inside certain professions or inside the government, who are able to live very comfortably. And equally, there are outsiders who haven't been able to get into those sort of closed circles. And they, as you say, are really, you know, they were not prosperous before this crisis, and they're even less prosperous now. So, I mean, I think you do raise a very fair and profound point. If I were a Greek and I were given a choice to vote in this referendum, do I want this bailout or not? I would think extremely carefully, because taking the bailout means, yes, after 10 years of pain, we can aspire to be a sort of Northern European nation and change ourselves. But it requires that 10 years of pain. So do I not want to exit the euro, go back to the drachma? We can devalue and we can get the economy back on a sort of level keel a lot faster. I mean, we may not have the long-run prosperity that staying in the euro generates, but do we want to take, you know, it's not just short-run pain, it's medium-term pain to get there. So it's a more profound question than I think people are sort of casually saying when they sort of suggest the Greeks are being ungrateful in talking about a referendum on this bailout.
Robin Harding, US economics editor for the Financial Times. We're going to go back to this question because I think, Courtney, you can fill us in too on some of these details. Courtney Kubi is here. James Kitfield is here. We'll have more of our international news roundup. We're also going to get to Syria and to France. Do stay with us. We're going to take a quick break.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. By American Jewish World Service, pursuing global justice through grassroots change at ajws.org. And by the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness on the web at melvilletrust.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, physicist Brian Greene explains why some astrophysicists think we live in a multitude of parallel universes. One possibility?
It's like a cosmic bubble bath of universes. Our universe is one bubble in this big cosmic bubble bath.
Greene's book, The Hidden Reality, is out in paperback, and he's hosting a new PBS Nova series. Join us.
Welcome back. I'm Cathy Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. You have joined the international hour of our Friday news roundup. And just before the break, Elizabeth called with a very interesting question, asking us to clarify effectively what the situation is in Greece and what standards of livings are, what tax rates are, how people are actually managing there. And she was saying that we were casting aspersions on the Greeks having a lavish lifestyle. Courtney, give us a bit more of the numbers.
Well, Elizabeth was right about one thing, and that's that when Prime Minister Papandreou took office in a couple of years ago, he realized that the previous administration had been cooking the books. So the Greek people, the idea that this was all something that came of them just acting irresponsibly, it probably is not fair, because you could argue that some of the Greek people just didn't know how much debt the government was in at that time. So what I meant by a lavish lifestyle, and I think that what's in a lot of the commentary in the media right now about that, is that Greek people, Greek citizens who work for the government, they enjoy tremendous benefits. And when you're looking at it from an outside perspective, especially if you're someone like Germany or China, who would potentially be spending billions of dollars to help out Greek, to help Greece not default on their debts, these people have a lot more benefits. They have pensions, they have, you know, higher salaries than what you would see in other nations. So that's where some of that commentary would come from, some of that analysis. It might not be fair to say that they all live lavish lifestyles. That's not true. But they do, people who work for the government do enjoy, or have up until now, enjoyed tremendous benefits.
I was reading Michael Lewis's book, Boomerang. I don't know if any of you have read it. It's a great kind of tour of European countries and how they all responded to the debt crisis. But he has some very interesting, and perhaps Elizabeth, it'd be interesting for you to look at this, some very interesting numbers on Greece, and particularly on the retirement age, that there is a retirement age of 50 in Greece for people who have jobs that are deemed to be arduous. But he points out that people like hairdressers, for example, have managed to say that their jobs, to classify their jobs as arduous in order to get that retirement age of 50. So, you know, clearly, there was a certain amount of people shafting perhaps their financial responsibilities, and that is coming back to hurt the country right now. Let's get to Syria, because I want to make sure that we have time to cover this. James Kitfield. This week, on Wednesday, Syria signed an agreement with the Arab League that seemed to augur a better period in the country's history. They agreed to open the country up to foreign journalists. They agreed to negotiate with the opposition, to take the tanks off the street, that kind of thing. The very next day, we had reports from Homs that people have been killed. I think a couple of dozen people have been killed by the Syrian government. Which is the Assad that we should believe? The one that signs the agreement with the Arab League, or the one that the next day sends the troops into the streets of Homs?
Believe the Assad as he does and not as he says, because he has constantly said, I'm ready to, you know, he convinced Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and many Europeans, including the Turkish Prime Minister Erdogan, that he was a reformer. And he kept promising these reforms that never appeared. And when the Arab Spring, you know, washed up to his doorstep, has been very brutal, consistently killing as many, the UN thinks, as 3,000 protesters, and he seems not to have changed. So, you know, there was a brief moment of hope when the Arab League went to Damascus and got this agreement, and, you know, seemed, if he was really wanted a chance to get out of the situation he's in and really reform, that was an opportunity to do that. It doesn't seem like he's doing that. I think this will solidify the view amongst the opposition that this guy is past the point of no return. We can't trust him. His hands are too bloody at this point, and he cannot be part of any solution. So I'm not hopeful that this as a turning point. I wish it was.
Robin, it's Friday, which means that, of course, it's the day that people go out to prayer, and the protesters have traditionally protested after the prayers. What happened today in Syria?
Well, so it appears that there were further protests and that the government sent the military into the cities again. I don't know much more beyond what's been reported.
But it hasn't been the situation that we've seen quiet in Syria today, Courtney.
Absolutely. There were more protests, more attacks in and around Damascus and Latakia. So it's more of the same. What's interesting is as long as this violence continues and Assad's agreement to accept the Arab League, it's just another stall tactic. That you can't argue that there's anything here that's legitimate in him saying that he's going to agree to
these. And the opposition is taking it as that?
Absolutely. And the problem, there's one continuing problem that's sort of the undercurrent throughout this entire violence, this entire Arab Spring in Syria, and that's this opposition, which, while continuing to grow, it still is not organized. There's not an opposition that Assad could really talk to right now. If this Arab League agreement really were to come to fruition, there's no real organized opposition for him to meet with. So, I mean, at this point, him agreeing to this Arab League is just another one of his stall tactics.
Robin, it's been nearly 8 months now that these protests have been taking place, and there doesn't seem to be any sign that they are going to pull back. I mean, at great risk to themselves, they're still turning out on the streets. They must now all be known by the security forces because presumably they've been filmed and photographed by the Assad regime. What's the situation with the international community? Where are we standing there?
Well, the international community escalates its rhetoric, but the trouble is it doesn't really have any good options. For sort of Libyan, there is no interventionist option. The Arab League that would not welcome intervention, and militarily, I understand, but it would be difficult to do. Sanctions have been applied, and they escalate the sanctions, and maybe the next step is to do a bit more of that and to try and persuade some of Syria's other neighbours, such as Turkey, to implement effective sanctions as well. But unlike in Libya, there really isn't any obvious option for the international community to effectively intervene.
I agree. I don't see a military intervention at all in the cards. NATO's not interested. The United States is not interested. The Arab League is not interested. And surely Russia and China are not interested in giving NATO another green light for a sort of intervention like that, because they thought that they went well beyond their writ that they gave them in the spring in Libya. However, I mean, I do think, you know, Turkey is ready to. Turkey's been feels very betrayed, really, by Assad. I think Turkey is ready to get on with tougher sanctions. I think the Europeans have talked about an oil embargo. I think that's going to be the next step, because there aren't any other good steps. But you know, increasingly Assad has no friends in the world, although the Chinese and the Russians are an impediment to really, really tough sanctions, because they have a traditional interest in that country, especially the Russians. So this thing lurches on, and I don't see him going anytime in the immediate future, but it gets harder and harder for me to imagine how this guy gets back to any kind of normal as the leader of that country.
Courtney, where do you think Assad goes? And then what's your sort of, what do you think the time frame is?
I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon. There are two good silver linings to this story so far, and that's that the sanctions that are already in place are having an effect on the economy, and that is putting stress on Assad and his government. The other is that the Arab League is the one who came forward with this agreement this week, and so he's facing further Arab isolation. As James was saying, Turkey, who was once a staunch ally of Assad, is now on the side of this opposition and is actively against the Assad regime. So I don't see anything happening soon with Assad certainly stepping down or being overthrown, but his days are numbered to some extent.
Okay, let's go back to the phones to Aaron in Washington, D.C. Aaron, you've joined the Diane Rehm Show. You have a question for the panel.
Hi, thanks
Hi.
For taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I'm calling because you guys have kind of said, danced around it a little bit, but one of my biggest problems with the debt crisis is that whenever I hear leverage or over-leverage or in regards to debt, I get this image of this money that over the last couple of decades has been conjured really out of thin air and only exists in on the books. And debt in general, you know, when we look at it in our checkbooks, it's in red. And I feel like what they have done is they have simply said, well, of course we'll pay our debt, and they just change it to a black in their, you know, financier's checkbook. And what we're doing now is we're paying on an over-leveraging of debt. We're paying money that doesn't actually exist except in the checkbooks of these people with billions and billions of dollars. And I was just wondering, is it even possible now to go back to, I guess what you would call the original collateral on all these debts that the world has accrued, and really have a real-world idea of what we owe? And I feel like really when it gets right down to it, the Greek protesters and the Wall Street protesters, what we're really upset about, even if we don't know it, is the fact that we're paying as taxpayers debt that these millionaires and billionaires have accrued that doesn't exist to us. It only exists because they've over-leveraged it to pay for things that it's like inflation. It's saying, well, of course it'll be worth this in 10 years, but the problem is we've reached a point where we didn't grow as fast as we could have, which originally wouldn't have been a problem if we were still looking at real world debt, but we aren't anymore. We're looking at this over-leveraged bubble of debt, and instead of the government saying we're going to pay down you know, the original cost, we're now trying to keep all of these people afloat. And that's where risk comes from. These people are all
okay, Aaron, I'm gonna jump in there because we've got a few nodding heads here in the studio, Robin.
I don't know about a nodding head, but I'll try and tackle that. So, you know, essentially what happened in the bubble is house prices kept going up, so people took on more debt, which let house prices go up more, so people took on more debt. And then the house prices fell, and there was a lot more debt left over than the house prices are worth. And so we've seen the Federal Reserve doing stimulus with very large numbers attached to it, and we've seen government stimulus with very large numbers attached to it, trying to resolve this situation. But I don't think it's fair to say that it's not real. What we've seen happen is that basically governments have stepped in and said, right, well, the private sector can't borrow anymore, so we're going to have to take over that role of providing demand in the economy. But the reason why the US is not recovering strongly is because households are trying to pay down their debts. They haven't magicked them away. They're trying to pay them down. And because they're trying to pay them down, they can't consume. And so I don't think it's fair to say this is all somehow magic or funny money. We're feeling the real pain from the real debt.
Of having overborrowed.
Yeah, precisely. And that's why, you know, there's no quick way out of this. The only quick way out of it would be to allow inflation to get out of control. And the Federal Reserve has made it very clear that's not happening, and there's absolutely no evidence that it's happening.
I'm Katty Kay. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join us, do call 1-800-433-8850 or send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. A couple of other stories that I want to get to. James, let's start with UNESCO giving the Palestinians full membership this week. Why did they decide to do it, and what was the reaction?
Well, we saw this coming in the last month at the General Assembly, where the Palestinians applied for full membership both in the Security Council and in these subsidiary UN arms like UNESCO. UNESCO did it because basically the Palestinian cause has a very sympathetic ear in the United Nations. A lot of, especially developing countries, side with the Palestinians, feel like they're an occupied people and they have a right to self-determination. So we're going to see more of this. It's also why the U.S., along with Israel, fought this in September, because it opens up a real can of worms now. Because now the U.S. and Israel have suspended their payments to UNESCO, which is going to call UNESCO's problems. It's going to cause Israel's supporters in Congress to talk about suspending payments to the UN in general, as long as this, you know, they're admitting the Palestinians into these various subsidiary groups as members. It's going to, you know, the Israelis, as they are wont to do, slammed the Palestinians for this move by announcing 2,000 more construction of housing in the occupied territories in East Jerusalem. They cut handing over the tax levies that they give to the Palestinians, custom levies, which is going to very quickly bring the Palestinian Authority to a crisis point in terms of its finances, which are not good anyway. So, you know, the Palestinians, if they're on their tether and they're doing things to try to sort of win world opinion, which I am sympathetic to, but they're doing it in a way that makes it very hard for the United States to actually help them. You know, eventually we're going to have to find some way to get both these sides back to a negotiating table. Each of these steps is really a step away from the negotiating table, and I find that so we're not even a stalemate. The whole peace process is backsliding, and you know, every time it has backslid like this in the past, eventually violence occurs. And we now saw two boats are approaching Gaza trying to break that blockade. That led to violence last time that happened. We'll keep an eye on that, but the situation there is either moving forward or it's moving backwards, and we've been through an extended period in the last year and a half of moving backwards.
Okay, Courtney Kuby, another story that I'd like to get to just before we end the program. France, the office of the weekly publication Charlie Hebdo, was firebombed in France this week. Why?
Well, they had just completed a spoof issue that was quote-unquote guest-edited by the Prophet Muhammad, and it included images of him, cartoons of him. You know, of course, this was also the same publication that in 2006 republished the cartoons that were in a Danish newspaper that caused tremendous unrest throughout the Middle East. It's a publication that continues to push the limits between satire and what they can get away with under freedom of expression, freedom of the press. And the problem is, in France, it's the largest Muslim population in Europe, and there was an outcry. There was
no one's claimed responsibility for the firebombing. Is that right?
Not yet. And there was one of the editors even said something like, "Well, this could have just been some drunk people. We don't know." But the police think it was a Molotov cocktail, and there have been threats against the people who work in the office. So it appears to be targeted. It appears to be because of this publication that was about to come out and has since now come out. Another organization, another newspaper, printed some of the cartoons along with an explanation for why they were doing it. You know, it's a publication that's known for pushing the limits, and the only difference this time was the target, and that was Muhammad, which, of course, in Islam, there's not allowed to be representations of the Prophet Muhammad. It's a tremendous insult to Islam. But the fact is, it's a satirical publication, and they have the right to express. They have the right to freedom of expression.
James, are we still in a situation, though, where something like this with Charlie Hebdo could cause knock-on effects, as we saw with the Danish cartoons? I mean, are the tensions still at that level?
You know, I think the tensions are less now, but the tensions are, I mean, people died because of that earlier,
right.
All over the world. I mean, that was very, very objectionable to, you know, a majority of Muslims to see their religious leader depicted in any way, but certainly in a sort of satirical, laughable fashion. I heard a comment from a French Muslim who I think got it exactly right, which is that just because you can do this thing, because you have a First Amendment right or you have a right to free expression in Western societies, doesn't mean you should do them. So I think I would hope we get to a place where we can condemn this constant provocation. Why these provocations to a vast minority group inside of France? I think it's irresponsible,
particularly when you already have tensions with those communities.
Right, and people can die. I think it's irresponsible. I would defend to the last straw their right to do it. I just hope we get to a place where the people who do this get condemned by society and for constantly provoking crisis that we don't need right now.
Okay. Yeah, we certainly don't need another crisis. After all that we've been talking about this week, one crisis we don't need with the firebombing of the magazine Charlie Hebdo. James Kitfield, senior correspondent with the National Journal. Courtney Cuby, national security producer for NBC News. Robin Harding, U.S. economics editor, Financial Times. Thank you all so much for joining me. It's been an incredibly busy week, yet another busy week on the international scene, I suspect, with everything that's happening in Greece and Europe. We're going to fill another hour easily next week as well. Thank you all so much for joining me.
Thank you.
I'm Caddy Kay of the BBC. I've been sitting in for Diane Rehm. Diane is up in Maine. She's on a station visit. She will be back on Monday. Thank you so much for listening, all of you. Do have a great weekend.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from CenturyLink, providing broadband, entertainment, and voice products to Americans coast to coast. Learn more at CenturyLink.com. From MetLife Foundation, committed to promoting healthy families and good nutrition, on the web at MetLife.org. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting this year's community health leaders, working to improve health in communities nationwide, at communityhealthleaders.org. This is NPR.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, more than 1 million bats have died from white nose syndrome in the past 4 years. What's causing the disease? How a declining bat population affects the environment and the US economy, and the prospects for a cure.